Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the first of our two spoiler special podcasts for The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. If you want to hear four Empire journalists nattering away about the concluding chapter in Peter Jackson's Hobbit saga, then you have to wait a couple of days, and we will have the second spoiler special out. That will also include an interview with Richard Armitage, who plays Thorin Oakenshield, so do listen for that. In the meantime, this podcast is dedicated to the co-writer of The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, the two previous films, and indeed the Lord of the Rings trilogy as well, Philippa Boyens. She came to London recently and she spoke to two of our biggest Lord of the Rings experts, Helen O'Hara, and the guy who's been on set of every Rings movie, bar The Fellowship of the Ring, Ian Nathan. Do enjoy. But of course, as ever, an addendum, this is a spoiler special. A spoiler special. So if you haven't seen The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, or if you haven't read the book, then do so. And then come back, because believe me, they delve into deep, deep third act territory. Do enjoy.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to be here.
So this is I think it's fair to say, a pretty faithful adaptation of the third of the book. We're going to talk, I guess, anyway, about, you know, what changes you had to make, you know, what was different, what was new. One thing that immediately leapt out at me, quite literally, the giant weirworms. Is Peter a Dune fan? Is that where that came from?
No, actually, you know what? For the true geeks out there is a... they come from Bilbo Baggins in the very first chapter of The Hobbit. And when we were discussing the... because what we didn't want was to repeat ourselves, obviously. And, you know, it's another battle scene. Helm's Deep, you had the orcs marching on Helm's Deep. And, you know, that incredibly tense standoff. Pelennor Fields, the Battle of Pelennor Fields was coming for like 40 minutes before it actually happened. You know, you know, Pete wanted to do something very, very different. He wanted this to, and I have to say, we are being faithful to the book here, because the orcs do come upon them out of nowhere. Yeah. And in the book, it's described as they burst out of the wastelands and they come from the earth. And then when we were talking about this, I said, you know, because that is slightly strange. It presupposes giant tunnels up in the thing, you know. Mm. And I said, well, you know, there were giant weirworms, of course, referenced at the very beginning. So that's where they came from. So they actually are from Professor Tolkien. It was a liberty, though, having said that. But I like that we're kind of teasing the fans when we have the orc Azog reference the Earth Eaters, yes. The giant Earth Eaters.
I mean, it's such a huge battle scene. You've got so many kind of moments going on. Were there particular bits that you wanted to kind of pull out? Because obviously in the book, you know, Bilbo's unconscious for most of it, really, which there's a nod to here. But were there, you know, when it came to making the battle, I guess you had more free rein than normally is the case.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, we did actually look at that structurally. Now that I think about it, we did actually look about is that possibly a way to tell this.
There is a procession in the book, isn't it?
Yes.
So one thing happens, followed by the next.
And he's knocked out and comes to and then understands what has happened. And, you know, we felt, you know, ultimately you understand that you can't do that on film. So we do knock him out and things do keep going, but it's not received after the fact. Yeah. And one of the earliest changes that I felt really strongly about, even though we tried it both ways, we did write a scene where Bilbo came to Thorin, as he does in the book. And I said, this is wrong. It should be a death scene on a battlefield. Mm. And, you know, it's even people who know the book really well forget that doesn't happen that way. And yet it feels so right, I think. Because that's the difference between prose and filmmaking. There needs to be an immediacy to it. And having, you know, Gandalf come and find Bilbo and then take him off to see Thorin and Thorin's lying on his deathbed just would have just killed that moment, I think. In terms of film, it plays so differently.
Yeah. And also, I mean, in terms of the battle, which was really interesting, in the book they say that the dwarves from the mountain help turn the tide.
Yes.
But it's kind of hard to imagine how that would be the case with 13 men.
Well, that's right. There were certain unanswered questions, and I think it was the nature and the very incredibly organic way in which Professor Tolkien wrote these stories. Let's face it, he introduces the character who kills the dragon 5 minutes before he does it, which, you know, is, I mean, I'm sorry, and I'm his biggest fan, but that was, you know, you can't do that on film. So we spent a lot of time setting up Bard, and I think most people have accepted that was the right choice and thing to do. But interestingly enough, in terms of what you're talking about, I think, you know, Pete has, he's not interested, number one, in repeating himself. And number two, he always wants things to be driven by character. you know, character, character, character. So you, and you know, I mean, you know, constantly you're thinking, people are only going to care about this battle, this war story, as much as they care about the characters and, you know, the people that it's happening to. So that we always had that, kept that in mind, and tried to balance that out. But also, a lot of people, it was really surprising, even people who love the book, mm-hmm. have forgotten how tragic the ending is.
Yeah.
They have forgotten that. But we always knew it, and we always saw that coming, and we were always trying to shape. That's why it felt right to break this chunk off, and to move towards that darker tone of The Lord of the Rings, which I think this film does do. But also I remember finding very much in the appendices of The Lord of the Rings a moment when Gandalf talks to, I think it could be Merry and Pippin or Frodo, to the hobbits, and he reminds them of how very different things would have gone but for the courage shown that day in front of the gates of Erebor, but for the courage of those dwarves and those men and those elves who stood. If that mountain had been taken, if Smaug had not been killed, the outcome for the rest of the story, meaning The Lord of the Rings, would have been very, very different.
It's a quite an interesting point. Mm. I think Richard Armitage asked the magazine this. And I'll repeat this. What is Sauron's plan for Smaug, you know?
Well,
has he got one? Are they in cahoots? Are they not?
We played with that. We played with that. That what he says again in the appendices is that, you know, the notion of a dragon at the head of a giant army of orcs is a terrible thing. We actually have Gandalf referencing that. Mm. You know, a dragon could be used to terrible effect. Now, I think ultimately, because we know that they were the creations of Melkor, who Sauron is a servant of, you know, an even older, more ancient, greater evil.
We're going deep Tolkien now, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Tolkien. We are. We're going deep, dude. I need Stephen Colbert. Yeah, but I think basically Sauron would have used him if he could have. And I think just in terms of his greed and his innate psychopathy, which I think is what Benedict liked playing with and being informed by, is that you can see it in Ben's performance. And he asked that question himself, how much does he know? Mm-hmm. How much is he enjoying toying, you know, with this little hobbit? And we do set it up in that conversation between Smaug and Bilbo. And he says, you know, you know, Thorin Oakenshield has no idea what's coming. So we're assuming an alliance between Smaug and a potential alliance between him and
Sauron.
Can
I ask about Benedict's other role, the necromancer?
Mm.
And it's another kind of problem Tolkien rather presents you, is that in a way you don't want the necromancer got rid of before the battle's done.
No.
Because, you know, he's the big bad, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's the Phantom Menace, I suppose. Yeah. Did you ever think about running those two stories more parallel? I know there's the Gandalf geography problem.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I can tell you, when I read Harry Potter and I read the Deathly Hallows, I was like, oh, no, damn. Because that, to me, is actually what Sauron was doing. He was trying to find his way back to take physical form. And it was like, ah, damn it, you know, because she wrote it so brilliantly. But it was what I think we would have done more strongly, and pushed that harder. That in my mind, if we'd ever had to do, you know, the Dolguldor, that's what it was about. His attempt to return to physical form. What Galadriel does when she takes him on what we've done, and we sort of drawn on what we imagine Professor Tolkien was doing with these characters, is she expends a lot of her power in banishing him from Dol Guldur. So when you meet her in The Lord of the Rings, she's diminished. She says that, you know. Yeah.
I will diminish and go into the West.
Go into the West.
I was geeking out at having the three elf rings together.
That was really exciting. Did you like that? Yeah. Well, you'll like the extended cut then, because there's more of that, and it's pretty cool. Yeah. In fact, the ring will play much more strongly in the extended cuts. Yeah.
I mean, how important was it to sort of like build up those little touches of kind of, I wouldn't call it, it's not about those dragon sickness, kind of ring sickness
yeah.
for Bilbo? Because, you know, already there's the sort of the shadow, I guess, hanging over him a little.
That was Fran, I have to say. Fran Walsh is so clever, such a... I hope she listens to this. Now I have to make her. No, but she is... She has this great expression when we're writing. She'll turn to me and we'll have just done something and I'll go, "What do you reckon?" And she'll go, "I really like it, but if we were really clever..." And I say, "What?" As opposed to being deeply stupid, which is... what we think we are. But if we were really clever, and I think she was really clever with this, is that we didn't want the multiple endings, which we were accused of for Lord of the Rings, that the best way to do that is the story isn't over. And so that moment when he lies to Gandalf, "Oh, I lost that ring." Mm. And that was a little homage to the fact that we know that he never really fully told the truth of, because he felt guilt and he also felt paranoid about, you know, this is Bilbo I'm talking about, yeah, has ownership of the ring. So we wanted to layer that in so that that moment when he opens, and that was brilliantly played by Martin, when he opens one eye and looks down in it and that little smile, cutting to Sir Ian Holm, you know, yeah, with it in his hand. It was very deliberate sort of thing that you wanted to do, where you're saying he's made it home, but what has he brought with him?
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Because it's sort of echoed, isn't it, by the Arkenstone?
Yes.
Because that carries with it a cost and a psychological, yeah, damage.
Yeah.
But I always kind of wonder, what is the power in Arkenstone?
We had to be really careful about that because, yeah, there's too many goddamn talismans. I can say fucking talismans. There's too many fucking talismans in this. Sorry, no offence. But, you know, like, again, I'm a real Tolkien fan, but Jesus, it doesn't make it easy when you're a screenwriter and you've got all these trinkets, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So what we did with the Arkenstone was, we, instead of imbuing it with actual power as the ring has, we tried to imbue it with symbolism. And the symbolism is, as he says in Bree, you know, that they swore an oath. So basically, if he can retrieve that stone, we made this up, it was just, yeah, a way of making it important because it needed more weight. You can't just send Bilbo in down in there to retrieve gold cups and things like that. You know, there needed to be a purpose. And the Arkenstone was about this belief that if he could retrieve this, the other seven dwarf families had sworn an oath to he who wields the Arkenstone, meaning that this is the true descendant of Durin, you know, that as we saw it. But what happens to Thorin is it becomes more than that, and that is about the dragon's sickness. Mm. And we totally ripped off Shakespeare with Balin's line, and only someone like Ken Stott, who's so brilliant, could deliver it when he says, "The Arkenstone, that jewel crowns all. It crowns all in this great mass of treasure." Mm. In Thorin's mind. Without it, it's not complete. And we very deliberately wanted to do that avarice where you cannot part with a single coin, not one piece of it. And we deliberately wanted that line shared by Smaug and by Thorin. And Richard actually came and heard Ben recording that line because he wanted to hear how he did it.
Right, and just get the same kind of intonation.
Yeah, and you can see him with his head swinging, you know, the serpentine and the S, the sibilant S in there, and yeah.
Wow, that'll be something for people to look out for.
Yeah, look out for when he does that. Yeah, and the horror on Bilbo's face when he hears those words coming out of his mouth. But that's about a special kind of greed, and it is, that's that line, and that's when I tried to sum it up. When he says, "Beyond sorrow and grief, gold beyond sorrow and grief," which to him means it is worth every life that we spend, you know, and this, yeah, is what he says to Dwalin. And we weren't trying to be thematic there. We weren't trying to, you know, hammer home a message. It was more about creating interesting moments in the storytelling and interesting moments for the character. And I love that when Dwalin finally confronts this man whom he loves and whom he is only ever his brother, you know, in essence. Like, what the fuck are you doing? Are we not going to go out there and fight? Are we truly going to... And Thorin's answer is, we've got to save the gold. This hall's deeper halls. We've got to move the gold. We've got to save the gold. And then that incredible bit that Pete did with with him almost being consumed by it.
Mm. Fascinating scene to shoot for this, a star sort of being pulled down a ramp on ropes and so on.
Poor bastard. We did so many cool things to that guy.
Did you ever, you say you didn't deliberately make it thematic, but I think people will read a bit of real politic into it because it is so anti-greed, the greed corrupts, and even Alfred is this kind of cowardly, but he hoards money.
Isn't he
money
brilliant?
As well.
I loved writing him. He was my favourite.
You know.
But it was funny because some people questioned that scene, you know, where he's stuffing his boobies full of gold. Now that, but it serves, but it serves I had an argument actually. It'll be interesting that I think British people kind of like Alfred and got him a lot more than Americans did. I don't know whether it's particularly a sort of Dickensian sort of nature.
Yeah, there is an element of that.
But it's also broader. But broader in an appropriate way, because sometimes the broad comedy, there's actual real cutting satire of truth in it. And what we wanted to do with him is that moment when he's stuffing his fake boobs full of gold, is what he's saying to Bard is, you could have had it all, but you threw it away. You could have had real power. You could have had this, but did you take advantage? No, you didn't. Yeah. And what we were trying to say there in that comic moment is that that's actually how a lot of people work. You know, that's what they're pursuing is the power that gold gives you, is the you know, wealth doesn't just give. I mean, you see, the funny thing is Thorin had innate power, and what happened with the dragon sickness is that he had gold for its own sake, which is an obscenity. That's a different kind of greed. What Alfred's talking about is what you can buy, and how you can buy people, and how you can buy power, and you know. Mm.
I wonder if he goes and moves to Rohan and changes his name to Worm.
Oh my God! That, do you know what? Yeah. You're right, actually, because I did think afterwards. I thought, oh God, did we just rewrite Wormtongue?
No, he's a different character, but there's certainly an element of.
Do you know how we originally wrote him as? We originally wrote him. We saw Alfred when we realized the reason we wrote an Alfred character was because. We wanted the master to have an offsider so he could have these conversations. And most of those conversations are the ones that you see in the extended cut of Desolation of Smaug. Poppycock, as Stephen Fry so brilliantly performed it. We wanted an offsider for the master, and we saw the master as this, you know, wonderfully venal character. But what happened in the... And so what we actually wrote initially was a very much a yes, Prime Minister type character, you know, the Nigel Hawthorne character, quite actually disgusted with the venality of him, you know, very interested in machinations and but a little bit more, you know, Game of Thrones sort of... not Game of Thrones, you know, to play the king, you know, the...
Yeah. House of Cards.
House of Cards. Slightly more politic, you know, all about the politics. And so that's how we originally wrote him. And then what happened was we saw Ryan Gage audition, and he was just so brilliant that suddenly Alfred became slightly more Dickensian there.
Can I ask about Azog?
Yes.
And how smart he is? Because I think, I haven't read the books, you come across the orcs are kind of, you know, the ground people, and they don't really show a great deal of intuitive qualities, as it were, you know. But here, clearly here, he's a general...
Yes.
And quite smart.
Well, yes. Well, I think it's what informs him, what he's created from. And, you know, there's that expression that Tolkien came up with, reckless hate, this reckless hate. He's a pure psychopath, I think. And so when you say smart, I would say cunning.
Because obviously he's on a, you know, he's got a master and he's got instructions and and he controls the battle with a great deal of aplomb, actually, for a lot of it.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't know. It's hard. I think there is a will there that is counter to what I thought Professor Tolkien's was writing about, which is the only way we're going to survive is through our decency and humanity, and that is countered by reckless hate. I've always kept in mind the Robert Frost poem Fire and Ice, when he says, you know, I think I know enough of hate to say that ice is also great and would suffice. You know, so, I mean, that's actually a perfect poem for The Hobbit, because he's talking about the desire, which is referenced by fire, and then that's like Smaug, and then
the ice, which is the when you know the battle on the ice field, and that's a cold, hard hate.
Yeah, and as ever, J.R.R. Tolkien got there before Game of Thrones.
Yes.
The other battle of fire and ice.
Yeah. Also, is it more on a more humorous sense? Bolg is his son, right?
Yes, but we couldn't say, we didn't want the father-son thing.
But is there a mother?
Well, that's right. No, supposedly not. I mean, that was, you know, that's one of the things where you just fudge it. You just kind of go, well, let's not go there. So we call him his spawn.
There's some kind of weird biology has gone on.
It's weird, it's bleh. You don't even want to think about how they procreate.
And pretty much by definition, there's no love lost between them anyway, so.
Yeah, exactly. No. There's no father-son kind of, yeah.
No bonding moments.
Not a lot.
I wanted to ask a couple of things that aren't, well, possibly I missed something, but weren't clear to me. First of all, when exactly did Gandalf know about the ring? Has he known since Moria?
Well, in the Lord of the Rings, he knows quite early on, once Bilbo. But he always assumes that it is a trinket. And he says in the Lord of the Rings, you know, there are many magic rings in this world. And we repeated that because we felt we needed to, because why doesn't he get a sense? Because he doesn't get a sense because it was destroyed, we imagined, lost, gone. And that was, I mean, you know, to be honest, it's a kind of great weakness in the storytelling in some ways, but it does give you fallibility in the character of Gandalf, and you know, we see that play out
because he doesn't really tie the rise again of Sauron.
No,
with the rings, kind
this
of
ring coming into the world. Yeah.
Gandalf's not that smart after all. It turns out.
And then a couple of things that sort of are, again, referenced at the end of the book, but they kind of happen off screen here, I'm guessing, hoping we'll see them in the extended edition. But, you know, Dane, Bard, and their sort of ongoing honours and so on, we didn't really see those at the end of the film.
No, you will see that. Yes, yeah. You will. Definitely, certainly with Dane, because he inherits the kingdom. And there's some lovely scenes there. In fact, a beautiful scene between Billy and Martin Freeman.
Oh, great.
Saying goodbye. So, yeah, hopefully Pete sticks it in.
And then Bard had so much more to do this time. For the same reasons you said, you know, you can't have him show up, kill the dragon, and, you know, never be heard from again. Really.
Well, I think what was great about Bard is you see someone being a natural leader, and then you see Thorin losing his shit and, you know, and getting more and more paranoid and imagining that, you know, that his right to rule is derived from a bauble, you know, like, you know, whereas what Dwalin's saying is actually what Bard is showing, which is natural leadership, is that there's people that you want to follow. And it's interesting because I find that with politics nowadays, especially, you know, the notion of leadership is almost gone, really, because, like, with social media, with the way that you get, you know, like, you get the way that politicians have to play with publicity, and, you know, it's like a chess game, but we're seeing behind this all been, the curtain's been lifted and everything. The actual notion of leadership is almost vanished, and I don't know if I want to be led, you know, and do we want to be led? And then you think, well, yeah, I think I would, if you know, you sort of yearn for the notion of being able to follow someone and think, wow, this person's the right person to be doing this job, and I'm really glad they're there, and it makes me feel better, you know.
Well, if Thorin's breakdown had been on Twitter, and then the dwarves outside
tweeting,
him,
you know? Exactly.
Unfriended him or something, I don't know.
Totally unfriended, that's genius.
Another thing I wanted to ask about, just very quickly, sorry, is Gundabar.
Yes. Gundabar.
Because it's not, I mean, I don't remember that. I've read the appendices. I've read the Silmarillion.
I did have to look
looking
it up
for that? Are you looking for that? Were you thinking about, are you going to ask about the mother? No, I
wasn't
Thranduil's
even.
Mother.
Oh, I was just, you know.
I mean, Legolas's mother. Sorry.
Actually, that's a good question. I did have Legolas down as a subject. It isn't the most well-known Middle Earth locale, I think it's fair to say. But it was it just a matter of, again, tying it back into the Lord of Rings a little bit?
Well, again, you know, just like the Weirworms, actually, it's actually set up in The Hobbit. You know, that's where the other army comes from, marches down from Gundabad. And it was the gateway to the great. You know, there is the fact that kingdom has, that fortress is again full of orcs is not a good sign, you know. And if that kingdom should rise again, the kingdom of Angmar, then, you know, Rivendell's pretty much screwed. You know, the Shire will be gone. You know, all of those things that over this you know, since the last alliance that, you know, managed to achieve a certain level of peace in the world, that would be wiped out, and a holocaust would probably follow.
Wow. Speaking back to Legolas a little bit, or actually sideways to Tauriel, I think a lot of people thought that you were introducing this new character essentially in order to kill her at the end. And possibly Radagast as well, because we don't hear much from him.
I don't think you can kill Radagast.
Oh, no way.
You can't.
Well, you know, you can't. No, the five wizards. No. Well, keep them intact. The Istari, Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, was there any discussion of either of them, you know, meeting sticky ends, or was it, you know, did you always want to keep them?
No, because we always knew she was linked to Keely. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, I mean, we did know, that's not true. Of course, we talked about it, but we quickly said, no, it's too easy to do that. Having said that, I did think retrospectively that young women, maybe especially coming to the film, starting with the first Hobbit film, going all the way through, we'll miss her in. But then you get to meet Arwen, so maybe all will be forgiven.
So it all works out.
And if Radagast did die, would he come back as Radagast the Grey? Would he go one step up?
He's come.
It's like Kung Fu or something. It's a brown belt.
Yeah. Getting there to white, Radagast the white.
That would be an amazing plan. Legolas's mum, then.
Yeah.
Is she an orc? Because we know that they're...
No. We know that the elves went to war on Gundabad at one stage on the Northern Kingdom. And what we wanted to do, and it's a backstory, and we actually wrote scenes with more of her in there, so it'll be interesting to see if Pete puts them in the extended cut, but more references to... What we wanted was Thranduil's character is... and his reasons for coming to the mountain is slightly less than honourable. And although we wanted, you know, we wanted to surprise the audience with Thranduil at the end, which is that, and the notion that we played with is that those gems were the last thing that he had of his wife. Right. You know, they were being made for her and when he lost her, and we always said, you know, and we even talked about maybe doing a flashback, but we never did. It was just too much, you know, bridge too far. But that he never talks about her, because when he says to her, says to Tauriel, what do you know of love? That's not coming from someone, she says there's no love in you. She's actually utterly wrong. He has loved so deeply that he can't go near it anymore. He can't broach it. He can't touch it. It is... not to be talked about. And so when he finally says to Legolas, your mother loved you more than anything, more than life, that's what we said to the actor in that moment, is she died saving her child.
Right.
So that was the conceit that we thought. So when you see Legolas staring at this place, you know, and yet he knows so very little about his mother and what happened, we thought, well, that's quite powerful. That's quite a powerful piece of storytelling. It doesn't really go anywhere. It's not necessarily in the films, but it helped inform the actors.
You did get that, I think, from Thranduil. You got an element of almost reconciliation between the two of them, which was nice. But so Legolas goes off on his own.
Yes.
But we do see him, he appears to be like a sort of an emissary or an ambassador of the Woodland Elves by the time of the Council of Elrond. So presumably there is a reconciliation.
Oh, yes, he does, because he brings Gollum. He goes, he finally met. I wanted to set up the meeting with him and Aragorn, because they go hunting for Gollum.
So that was a very deliberate
setup on.
Was it easy to balance that kind of stuff, the connective tissue?
Now that's fun bit. Yeah. Writing that bit was really fun. Being able to
Saruman going, leave him to me.
And then Thranduil saying to his son, you should go north as a ranger. You know, it's just like, it's one for the fans.
We were laughing in the office. Why doesn't anyone listen to Elrond? Yeah. No one gets it right. No, we should deal with this right now and sort it all out.
Let's do it, yeah.
No, we're fine.
Don't worry about it. I've got it. I've got this, you guys.
Yeah.
It was good to see Saruman in action as well.
Just
really fierce, top of his game, but still fighting with the good guys. That was a nice play.
It's such an honour working with Chris Lee. We had a running gag because he always would say... always still continues to say, Sir Christopher does, I won't be around Philippa to see the film. So, you know, and I was like, of course you're going to outlive all of us, I think.
He'll be here.
So it's wonderful that he is. And
that was great, wasn't he? You know, no sign of the aging, you know, he was really powerful.
And he's such a handsome man, yeah.
Speaking of handsomeness, I have one quick final question. Why do only handsome dwarves get killed?
I know, killed all the hot dwarves.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. What are you trying to say?
Dwarf, really?
Yes, it does. Yeah. What are you saying? You're not a
bomber is of a certain kind. They're very attractive.
Exactly. And to dwarf women, apparently, very attractive to dwarf women.
Really?
Yes. Bomber's got 14 children, we decided. And well, that's a tragedy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Was there ever the temptation to give poor Bomber a line? Just a goodbye?
I'm not going to say anything, but you do need to watch the extended cut.
Okay. That is a spoiler. It's a bomber. Sorry, spoiler.
And what, apart from a very long rest, what's next for you?
Been doing a few little things, which are quite fun. But I think a rest is due, only because I think at some stage you just need to, you know, recharge your batteries. But it does feel weird that I'm not going to write the words elf or orc or hobbit.
Can you go back again? And at any point just read the books again? Without having
I can't. I lost. I know. Very true. Not asking for pity or anything, because it's been an absolute privilege, an absolute it's just a dream to have been able to do this. But I have lost the books. I have lost them because I can't anymore. And I felt that actually, because it was my escape. It is where I used to go. So I've had to go and find other things.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for our first The Hobbit, the Battle of the Five Armies spoiler special. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Philippa Boyens. Don't forget, in a couple of days' time, the second spoiler special will be up, including an interview with Richard Armitage and four Empire journalists nattering away like idiots. See you then. Thanks. Bye.